Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Arizona law is clear on this point. No company has the right to endanger an entire community's health and safety for its own gain.
Now, 2 years later, executions in Arizona can still not be carried out humanely, yet the governor nonetheless is doing a 180 and is now vowing to once again carry out executions in the state.
He said that Dreamers had nothing to worry about, that he supported that recipient, and then rescinded the DACA program, and then said that he had a deal made with the Democrats and Republicans, and then all that fell through.
They don't want to see the chaos at the border. You know, we have a broken immigration system, but they are not asking for separations of family. They're not asking for us to get end birthright citizenship.
It was a close race, good candidates across the field, and, you know, I've got my Republican counterpart, and that's just how it goes sometimes. It could have easily been me on the other side of that.
And joining me to talk about Carrie Lake's new job in the Trump administration, AG Chris Mays' new lawsuit, and more are Marcus Delortino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Matt Grodsky of Matters of State Strategies. Matt, good morning to you.
Morning.
So, Marcus, let me start with you and Carrie Lake being named the director of Voice of America under the Trump administration. There had been some talk that maybe she would be ambassador to Mexico, which would require Senate confirmation. This new role does not. What are your thoughts on this?
I suspect that this will not be her last job in the Trump administration. This appointment's a bit strange in the fact that her boss is not appointed yet and hasn't even been named. Trump said, you know, I will do it shortly. Okay, but that person needs to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Last time Trump was in office, that took about 2 years to get that person appointed. So there's a huge timeline drag here. And in the meantime, this organization has set up a new governing structure within itself, which allows a board to fire that executive director, not the president, but the board. I just have a sneaking suspicion that she might not be there that long, that we might have a future position in the Trump administration shortly.
Do you think that she would be moving on from that to something else within the administration?
I do. I think it's going to take a lot longer than people think to get everything settled out. And there's 1,000 more opportunities of places that she could enter the administration.
Now, what do you think?
I absolutely agree with that. It does feel a little clickbaity to me. And I do think the thing that Democrats and the larger population across the electorate need to remember is Trump's strategy from the first term through the election to now has always been to flood the zone with different things to distract us, right? And I feel like this is right out of that playbook. So I think we would be wise to not try to take the bait every time and get hung up on the new shiny object, because I do think it's part of a broader strategy to kind of exhaust people, right, before we even get to January 20th, and to also take away some of the heat from some of the other folks that are trying to get, you know, appointed.
So by appointing someone like Carrie Lake, who is in many ways for a lot of people very controversial, maybe take some of the attention away from, for example, the Department of Defense nominee or the Director of National Intelligence nominee and put them on someone like Carrie Lake?
I think so. I think it's all part of that strategy to, look over here so that you forget to be upset about this, and then you feel overwhelmed, and then that's exactly where he likes everybody.
So, Marcus, I don't want to, like, go too far down this rabbit hole, but if Carrie Lake ends up with a different job in the Trump administration at some point, better job than head of VOA or something more low profile, do you think?
Oh, I can't name the exact job.
Sure.
But I think it will be something that could move a little bit faster than this job, and probably a better paycheck. But to Matt's point, I would also say that there's a story out this morning or last night that basically says, look, Matt Gaetz was the throw-up nominee so we could get Hogsworth through DOD. That is part of the strategy. There's no doubt.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about and stipulate before we start this that none of the three of us in this room are lawyers. But leave that there. Saying that Attorney General Chris Mays, who is, of course, an attorney, sued the Saudi company Fondamente this week. She's been sort of telegraphing that this move was coming for quite a while. This is a company that has an operation in La Paz County in western Arizona. They grow alfalfa, send it back to Saudi Arabia for their cows to eat. The Attorney General, Matt, is using kind of an interesting strategy here. She acknowledges it's not really been tested to use this way, these nuisance laws, to try to stop the groundwater pumping here. I want to ask about sort of the politics of all of this, mm-hmm. because, you know, water for the longest time, you guys both know this, was seen as sort of a bipartisan issue in Arizona. Recently, it's maybe become a little bit less so, especially on the state level, with the legislature not really being able to come to agreement between Democrats and Republicans, urban and rural lawmakers, on what to do about this. How is this going to play at the Capitol, do you think?
Well, it remains to be seen how it's going to play at the Capitol. But I think for Mays in particular, it's a great political win. I mean, she ran on this back in 2022. She's obviously taken action on it, still obviously continuing to do that. I think, and what I've seen on the ground talking with not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans, is beyond the legislature, the issue of water transcends politics, right? I mean, you've got people in agriculture that are stressed about it. People in metro areas are worried about, you know, what is it going to look like 10, 20 years from now? And the very simple concept of foreign company taking our water resources and essentially shipping it overseas, for lack of a better explanation, that resonates with people. So I think from a political perspective, it's a good thing for the AG to keep up.
Marcus, what do you think?
I think Chris had a banner week, probably maybe one of her best since she's been in office, one with this announcement. I mean, honestly, how are you going to lose on this one? You're opposing a foreign, richer than rich government who's taking our water, and then the asset that they're getting from that water, they're shipping overseas. I mean, come on. So that was her first win. And then the one that's really undervalued, I think, that I'm hearing from more and more people is the merger, the
Kroger
proposed
Albertsons.
Merger of Kroger and Albertsons.
Which is blocked this week by
which
a judge.
Which was blocked this week, and Chris was passionate about that issue. And I'm with her on it, frankly, as the one who has to go do the most grocery shopping in my house. But the only person who was louder about it than me was my mother. My God. And so she was, it was a great week for her.
Well, so let me ask you this then. Does this help Chris Mays win over people like your mom?
Oh, you know, we don't even have a nominee on the Republican side yet.
Sure.
So God only knows how that goes. But I will tell you, my mom now knows who Chris Mays is.
Okay. As opposed to before.
I know you'll find this shocking, but not everybody in my family is glued to the political section of the newspaper. But
good for them.
But she's, I think she was excited. But oddly enough, she was more excited about the anti-Kroger Albertsons decision than water. But both were big wins for her politically. And I think Republicans should sort of tune into on the water side, particularly moving into this session.
Well, so Matt, Marcus said, you know, who's going to oppose going after a very wealthy foreign government, taking water here and shipping the assets overseas. But we saw earlier this year, there are some Republican lawmakers who tried to put in a bill that the governor vetoed to stop Mays from using nuisance lawsuits, understanding that this was at least one of the companies she was going to go after. So presumably it's not all sunshine and lollipops for
her. It's a great question. I mean, logically, you'd think no one would oppose that. But I think folks in the legislature on the Republican side tend to bank on average voter not getting that information, not knowing that part of the story. So I would argue it's incumbent on Democrats as a party, as a messaging apparatus. Obviously, the Mays campaign, once that gets up and going, to tell that story, right? Because it defies common sense, and that will resonate with people across the political spectrum. And I don't know Marcus's mom. She sounds wonderful. But I imagine more voters like that, who maybe weren't familiar with it to begin with, will tune in and see, okay, you know, that seems like a logical step. Why would anyone get in the way of that?
In the category of putting the cart miles and miles before the horse here.
Sure.
Let me just ask about the next election. Why not? I mean, there are people already saying they're running for stuff. Chris Mays has said that she's going to run for AG again. There's been speculation maybe she would run for governor or something else. Does this, something like this, Matt, help her, especially with more rural voters in terms of maybe not just the groundwater issue, but maybe, as Marcus brought up, the grocery merger as well?
Yeah, well, first off, I think everyone in the executive is going to be running for reelect in their positions. But yeah, I think it absolutely does. Remember, she's from a rural community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there's anything that Democrats need to take from this past cycle is that we need to talk more with folks in rural counties across the state. So I think this story definitely resonates.
Marcus, do you think this helps Chris Mayes in places where Democrats have been struggling?
Yeah, I think, and Chris is probably doing the most out of it out of any Democratic candidate out there. But if you noticed her town halls in La Paz County, particularly packed, absolutely packed. And that's not exactly known as a liberal bastion. And then when she also did town halls, and this was a smart move strategy on the merger of Safeway and Fry's, and those town halls were packed, and they weren't just packed by Democrats. So she's using these issues strategically to her advantage.
So in terms of if you are Chris Mayes, and I don't think anybody's suggesting she doesn't actually believe in these issues, that she's, you know, she wasn't using the merger, for example, as a political issue. I think she really believed that she's talked about this groundwater issue from when she was running for AG in the first place. But again, we're a long way out from another election, and these, you know, water is one of those issues that everybody talks about being important, but in terms of how you vote, not usually in the top few issue areas of how people decide to vote. Is there work to do to sort of tie these together to make it salient to voters in, you know, a year and a half?
Yeah, I absolutely think there is. I mean, you use those town halls and that energy to sort of build support so you can pivot into other issues. I don't think that the landscape is going to change too dramatically over the next 2 years. I think illegal immigration will continue to be the number one issue in the country. I think inflation in the economy will continue to be the number two, three issue in the country. And so you're going to have to pivot on that. And then, you know, the rumor, and I will just say it's the rumor, is that one of the Republican nominees for AG would be the current Senate President Warren Peterson. And he's definitely got experience in home building and development, and that comes with water experience too. So there'll be a counterpoint on that. But they're also for the next 2 years at the legislature, sort of a battle of the heads. If the AG is going to try and pass something, it's going to be difficult, I would say, through the Senate.
Matt, do you think that this lawsuit makes it more difficult, less difficult, no difference in difficulty in terms of trying to get big water stuff done at the legislature next year?
It depends on what the legislature wants to do in terms of if they want to either throw a wrench in that or if they actually want to cooperate. But I think regardless of what they decide to do, I think that to Marcus's point, a lot of these issues are still going to be top of mind, 2 years from now. And unfortunately, water is still going to be a problem for us at that stage. So I think tying this all together in a package for a reelect and talking about what we need to focus on long term, I think that's something that the party and the AG can focus on in their messaging.
Guys, let's start this segment with news from the Arizona Republic. They reported about the attendance records of Arizona's outgoing senior senator, Kirsten Sinema. She's apparently missed a lot of votes, Matt, as her term has come to an end. Or is coming to an end.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of my senior year of high school. I think she's got a case of senioritis there. You know, she's just moving on to the next thing. You know, don't need to show up for these votes anymore. I don't know. It's very interesting. But, I think she kind of saw the writing on the wall, obviously, over a year ago, which is why she switched parties, obviously didn't seek reelection. So I imagine she's kind of mentally on to the next thing at this stage.
Marcus, is this surprising? Is this sort of a case of senioritis?
It's, first of all, let's be clear. There's no critical bills happening in the U.S. Senate right now. Like, it's not going to be the end of the earth, number one. Number two is her vote isn't going to be the deciding vote on any particular issue. But I am constantly amazed at the following of Kirsten Sinema, especially by the Arizona Republic, who's just not going to be happy until they beat her to a pulp. Also within the Democratic base, I mean, it's just never let her go. Let's just keep pounding on her. Look, she lost an election. She's entitled to take some time off. Again, her vote is not going to be the deciding vote on any of these things. Why are we still fascinated with whether she's going up for votes or not? Why don't we focus on what's coming down the pike? How is Rubin organizing? How is his office coming along? Is he ready to, what's going to be his first piece of major legislation?
I wonder, though, is it kind of a bad look for a senator who makes a pretty decent salary to basically not be showing up to vote? Or does that maybe not, as you point out, maybe it doesn't matter that much?
I'd be more concerned if her constituent services weren't getting done, and that's really where the rubber meets the road. And I would tell you that she probably has the best constituent service operation in the delegation right now. And so if you need a passport, you're calling her. If you need your Social Security check is late, whatever that federal interaction happens to be, all that stuff is continuing to happen. So, look, I'm not losing sleep over it. I'll tell you that much.
Okay. So, Matt, Marcus referenced how the Democratic base has, you know, kind of enjoyed taking some shots at Senator Sinema over the last couple of years. Is this just kind of an example of that? I mean, does it matter that she's not actually voting on these
things? Well, it brings up a good point that, you know, there's nothing absolutely critical at this stage. I do know that there's still a sentiment across the board in the party that they kind of felt betrayed and let down by some of the decisions that she made. Now, at the end of the day, yes, constituent services, that is where the rubber meets the road. You know, I don't think any of that has stalled to any degree. I also am not convinced that voters necessarily care much right now in December, a couple weeks before the holidays ramp up. But I just think it's an interesting decision to make in terms of legacy, how you'd want to end things, because she has taken it seriously, and she obviously has been passionate about her role there. So it's interesting, I think, is the way I would characterize
it. The irony
that.
Is, I mean, Joe Biden should be, like, going somewhere with her. I mean, he owes every success in his presidency to Kyrsten Sinema. And I just find it laughable that none of the Democrats want to celebrate that success that she's solely responsible for, did the groundwork on. But we're going to have the Arizona Republic, you know, pound on her one last time. So anyway, sorry, I'm on my soapbox.
Do you think there's any chance that President Biden and Senator Sinema are, like, traveling together at all?
Oh, God, no, he's not traveling.
That seems like an unlikely traveling duo at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if you notice the close of before he got out of the race, you know, there was a lot of visits to states, swing states on the East Coast. But getting him to come out to Arizona was somewhat of a chore because it's a longer flight. And I think that should give you sort of an inclination of where the president is right now.
All right. So, guys, we have the five finalists for the new Supreme Court justice. And again, stipulating none of us are lawyers. I want to ask, though, Matt, like, what do you think that Governor Hobbs will be and maybe should be looking for? We obviously, you know, it's been narrowed down from, I think it was like 18 or something was the original number of people who applied. It's sort of slowly been narrowed down. We now have the five finalists. What do you think the governor should be looking for when she speaks with these individuals?
Well, it's an interesting thing because these aren't, you know, the way most people think about Supreme Court things is at the national level, right?
Yep.
Where these are lifetime appointments. That's not the case here. You know, we have a unique situation.
And they don't have to be confirmed by the Senate.
Correct. And we haven't had a situation where a Democratic governor has been able to do something like this since, I believe it's 2005. So I think what she'll be looking for is a way to kind of cement a legacy as much as she can, given the way that the elections work for these positions. So I imagine that of the choices, you know, these individuals are going to be a Democrat or have Democratic leaning tendencies that will be sympathetic to more of our views. It's not going to change the makeup to any degree, but I think that's what she's looking for.
Do you think that the way that she's approaching this changes at all, knowing that the two justices who are on the ballot up for retention are staying on the bench?
I don't think so necessarily. I mean, I think they've gone about this in a very methodical way. You know, they're not giving any hints one way or the other. So I don't think it changes it too much. But I just do think that she's looking for, okay, what is this going to do long term, you know, past the time when I'm governor, right? And I think that's the main focus.
Marcus, what do you think the governor maybe can and maybe should be looking for?
Somebody who can interpret the law fairly. I mean, that's the job. And it shouldn't be that hard, but occasionally it is. You know, if you go back over those two judges who you just mentioned who were up for retention, the controversy surrounding them, which I didn't think was a controversy, but was that they interpreted a state law correctly, by the way, that the legislature had written to send us back to the territorial days interpretation of law on the abortion, right? And so the Democrats were angry with those two. And wanted to vote them out, if you will. And that, of course, didn't happen. But what they did was interpret – if you wanted to be angry with somebody in that, you had to be angry with the legislature because they wrote the law. They interpret the law, and they interpreted it, fairly, I think. And so, you know, so you're looking for somebody who can actually interpret the law fairly, number one. Number two is I'm sure she's going to look for somebody who's got some likeness in her policy decisions, whether it's water, pro-choice, education, ESAs, that type of thing. But I will tell you, it should be difficult because all you're doing is interpreting the law. It should be difficult to make a counter-conclusion that is absolutely opposite of what was written on the paper.
How much do any of you think age comes into this? Because to Matt's point, it's not a lifetime appointment. There is a mandatory retirement age. But if you pick somebody who is, let's say, a decade or two closer to that retirement age, that seems like, if you're Governor Hobbs, that's a disadvantage.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way to look at that. I also think, again, not a lawyer, but the interpretation of these things, I think there is a generational component to some of these issues, right? And I do think that there's a benefit to an individual that is a little bit younger, right, who kind of sees things through a different lens than someone who might be a couple decades older. So I think that's something they might be considering, but that's certainly how I would look at it if I was making the decision.
Marcus, do you think age and years that somebody could serve on the court plays into this?
Much more down the line. I do think that more likely than not, it'll probably be a woman. I'm just spitballing and taking a wild guess. But I think when you get down to that sort of that level of detail, how long they can serve is probably less down there in qualifications. You're going to be wondering what kind of job they can do, most importantly.
Does this in any way become, I don't want to say a campaign issue, but does who she picks become a political issue in some way? Does it become a controversy at the Capitol in some way? Or does it, she makes her pick and then we all sort of move on, Marcus?
I think it's more likely that she makes her pick and we move on. One, the general electorate, frankly, could care less. I hate to break it to everybody, but and two, by the time that happens, we're going into legislative session and everybody's hair is going to be on fire with whatever the issue of the day is, water, education, ESAs. Budget. So it's too easy to get distracted.
Okay. Matt, do you agree with Marcus?
I absolutely agree with that. I don't think the general election is going to be moved by this. Now, does the opposition try to make hay out of it, remind people about it later on? Maybe, but I don't think it's that consequential in terms of political optics long term.
All right. Fair enough. Matt Grodzki, Marcus Dellartino, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.